Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, here with my two compatriots, Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello.
And Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello, gentlemen. Apologies to the fine listeners at home. we were supposed to have this review of Boyhood out last week, and events continuously conspired to keep us away. We were going to do it Sunday, and then that didn't work, and then we were going to do it Monday, and then that didn't work, and then I can't even remember. I think we tried for Tuesday, and then
that didn't work.
And then we knew that it wouldn't work Wednesday or Thursday, and then by that point we were just like, you know what, let's just do it on Sunday. Oddly enough, we were supposed to do it 9 hours ago, and then my computer died. But it's back. We're back. Apologies for the lateness of this review. But I'm actually a little excited about it because it did give me more time with the movie in my head. And this is a movie that, I think requires a lot of reflection. There's an immediate impact after the movie's over, obviously, but I'm glad that I'll have a little bit of distance so that maybe I can articulate myself better than I usually do with a movie that's like this, where I have to immediately start jibing with stuff. I won't have to have a Snowpiercer-style introduction next week where I'm like, I know I said this, but I saw it again, or I thought about it more, and now I have more to say. So you should all feel very lucky. there will be no discussion topic today. We were toying with some stuff. Obviously, San Diego Comic-Con happened. But compared to the previous years, just looking at Twitter, it didn't really feel like there was a lot going on at this one. A lot of the stuff, it was a lot of concept art, a lot of pictures, not really stuff that's good for radio. So, you know, that's about that. I'm sure that there's all kinds of stuff you can find on our site that'll give you some ideas of what's going on at Comic-Con, but we're just gonna skip past all that. Let's just get into our main review. And that's going to be of Boyhood, the newest film by Richard Linklater, starring Ellar Coltrane, Patricia Arquette, Ethan Hawke, and Lorelei Linklater.
Go.
I don't wanna be your hero.
It's a nice song.
It is. I like that song. The way it's deployed.
It's a nice trailer.
The way it's deployed in the movie is like, let me go. Anyway, so Boyhood. I'm just gonna. Okay. Every single person on Earth brings this up when talking about this movie, so we're gonna really kick it out of the way early, so that we can talk about the film. This is a movie that was made over the course of 12 years. Richard Linklater casts Ellar Coltrane as a 6-year-old and basically revisits him once a year for 12 years to chart his growth, but not in a documentary sense. It's applied to a fictional narrative. So basically an actor returning to the same role year after year for 12 years to tell the story of a young boy in Texas growing up and basically coming, you know, through boyhood and into what we culturally consider manhood. That's it. That's the plot of the movie. He's not unraveling a big conspiracy. He's not trying to, you know, solve the death or murder of someone. It's just life. So let's see if the concept of a life lived distilled down into a nearly 3-hour movie is appealing to us. And we'll begin with Nick Newman. Nick Newman, what did you think of Boyhood?
Just throwing it right at me.
Yeah.
I don't think this is a film that you can just sort of sum up when the question is thrown right at you. I remember actually when I saw this, it's been about maybe a month and a half. So I've had a lot of time to sit on it. to think about it, let it stew. And I remember people, you know, after I saw them, after I told them I saw it, they would ask me, oh, what did you think of it? And I kind of spent, you know, 2.5 minutes going, well. And thankfully, with the time having passed, I can sort of elide over that and try to get more to the point. First of all, I really liked the film, just speaking the most broad of senses. It's one of those special movies that I think clearly improves as it progresses. It almost improves scene by scene, even. And by the end of it, builds to this sort of rapturous conclusion, which also means that there is a period where I was not completely on board with it. There is a period where I found myself not really acclimated to its rhythms, not really in the groove with it. I'm not exactly sure why this is. I think it might be the peculiar structuring of it, the moving from year to year without announcing itself. There are no title cards. There are no... Even the transitions themselves, when you go from the first year to the second year, you'll only really notice the difference because of the way the boy's hair changes, I noticed. When you go from one year to the next, sometimes it's a hair change, sometimes it's something as small as an earring that he has. Sometimes it's like a change in, a slight change in stature for someone like Ethan Hawke, who seems to have aged 50 years in this film for some reason. I'm not sure what happens here, but, you know, of course the kids look different from being 10. Patricia Arquette looks relatively close. I mean, she ages a bit, but it's 12 years. Whereas Ethan Hawke, I mean, she looks like she ages maybe like 7 years. Ethan Hawke looks like he's gone through a lifetime. It looks like he's gone through hell by the time we come to the end of this.
I think it was filming Getaway is the problem.
Filming Getaway, I think so. Well, I mean, for reference... You know, the first time he shows up in this film would have actually probably been right before he and Richard Linklater shot Before Sunset. So mm-hmm. If you want an idea of what he looks like there, and then something strange happens. So anyway, I'm getting a bit off track here. Structurally, I was finding myself a bit troubled with it, and I think that part of it is because there is a very clear point where Mason, the main character played by Ellar Coltrane, becomes the main character. Mm-hmm. Before that, there is sort of this focus on, an equal focus on his sister and his mother, and it's not that their story isn't interesting, but when the movie is called Boyhood, I think expectations, and also when the seed of the film is all about how it follows this boy, how it shows him age, there was something kind of distracting. It felt like the conceit was weighing it down in a weird way, because I wasn't entirely sure how I was supposed to go with it. And then after a certain point, I can actually think of an exact shot where it leads it, where it starts to take off. And from there, the movie kind of just does not slow down. And pretty much every review of this movie, I mean, most reviews, overwhelming majority of reviews have been positive. And pretty much every positive review says, you know, it's a movie of small moments that coalesce and build into something overwhelmingly powerful, which is true. But I guess for me, there's something almost a little disingenuous about saying that, because I think that the moments aren't necessarily small for him. I think that there are a lot of big moments for him in this movie. They just seem small compared to most coming-of-age tales and the way they're sort of interspersed throughout the film. Thinking back on it, I sort of have this, not theory, but I somewhat, part of me thinks that this is not so much following someone year to year as it is someone reflecting back on their life from a certain distance and kind of having these memories that are marked by placeholders like music or video games or references to popular culture or certain striking images that are striking for the emotional effect they have on a person, for the experiences that they conjure. Part of me thinks the movie might actually be taking that approach, just not announcing itself as doing that. But even if it isn't, it sort of has that effect for me, where you think back on these things and they don't seem small because they just, for reasons that are almost unexplainable, they don't seem small because they're a part of your life. There were sort of these moments where you kind of stop and you think, you know, how did you get to this point? What led you here? Who are you? The movie is sort of haunted by. And I found the movie weirdly haunting. which is strange to say because a lot of it is in sort of a classic Richard Linklater fashion, sort of unassuming. But it's one of those movies that I felt like I was watching the production of as I was watching the film itself. And it kind of got me thinking about decisions people make and the people they choose to include in their lives and how those decisions affect you and the many paths your life may take. And when the movie ended, I kind of, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't worried for the main character, but I wanted to keep going with him. You know, you become very well-suited to his presence. And I think that has a lot to do with the boy himself, eventually the man, because, I mean, I don't know if you guys were surprised, but I was genuinely surprised by Coltrane's performance because, again, there's something very nondescript about him in those early moments, and then he becomes a very strong screen presence. He becomes a very magnetic screen presence, someone who is very enjoyable to watch, both because you can tell that he has acting talent, but also because he's very affable. He actually reminds me of a specific friend who actually just graduated college and who I have no idea, you know, when I'm ever going to see them again. So the movie kind of had a personal effect, you know, for me in that sense. But I think the movie is stronger than just identifications. I think that Richard Linklater, you know, remains a, you know, this is simplifying it, needless to say, but he remains a very good filmmaker. He has an eye for place and he has an eye for people and an ear for dialogue, which gives the movie this naturalistic tone, but not naturalistic in a, not naturalistic in sort of a rough sense. It all feels very polished. Despite some moments that I really do want to get into, because I think that you have to discuss these things. I'll give you two words, drunken stepfather. There. Now you know exactly that kind of, those two words say about a million. The first one specifically.
Okay. I'm hiding that shit behind the detergent.
So the personal connections it has for you, but those kind of come up because that's what the film is really going for. It's one of those acts of, it's one of those acts of formalism that is strong because it doesn't call attention to itself. So, so those are just some scattered thoughts on it. I've been going for several minutes now, so I should really hand it off to someone else, please.
All right, Danny King, what did you think of Boyhood?
Yeah, good start. I also really liked the film just generally. Although, like Nick, there was also an adjustment period for me in the beginning portions of the film, because there's this sort of huge disconnect between the concept of the movie and the hype, which have both been kind of so epic, and the content itself, which is often like almost shockingly mundane. I remember like one of the earliest scenes is like Linklater's daughter, Laura Lee, and she just wakes up and starts singing Oops, I Did It Again. And it's like a 2-minute scene maybe. And I remember sitting there like I just remember sitting there like, what? Like I like waited 12 years to like see some random girl like do a Britney Spears impression. Like this isn't really like the grand achievement I was expecting. And actually a lot of people I've talked to about the movie, not necessarily critics, but just sort of friends, have expressed that to me, where like they were expecting this sort of overwhelming emotional experience, I guess, and that's not necessarily what's in the cards in the film. Because I think a really good point that Nick made is like the disparity between moments that might feel small for us but that feel very important for Mason. I found one early shot really haunting, where it's the first time they move and he looks back to look at his friend, but he's already covered up by the bushes, and so you can't even see him. And for us, this is like, you know, 10 minutes into the movie, so it's pretty much like just on to the next scene. But, I mean, if I was that kid and I just lost my best friend, if that scene would have gone on for a couple more minutes, I could have seen myself like crying or something, and it would have been a really profound experience. But the way the movie handles its time jumps, it kind of just goes by very quickly. And then there is also the drunken stepfather thing, which I guess we can get into later. One other point Nick made that I was maybe more positive on was how much the movie focused on the parents and the adults. One of my favorite scenes is when Ethan Hawke is driving his kids to a baseball game and he's asking them questions. And I guess by this point, the girl's probably a teenager and Mason might be like, I don't know, 10 or something. And so they're both like really quiet and giving him these short answers. And he actually pulls the car over and gives them a really long speech about what he wants them to be like when he's around them. And I thought it was a pretty unusually honest and kind of surprising portrait of what, of just stating what parents sometimes want out of parenthood. He just kind of comes out and says what he wants his relationship to be like with his kids, and I found that kind of frank and unusual. And later in the film, which might be kind of spoiler a little bit for now, but Patricia Arquette, the way she comes to understand her, what she's accomplished as a mother and what her life is going to be like after Mason leaves, is kind of tragic in its own way. So all of that I was surprised by, because the movie is called Boyhood and you sort of expect the movie to just focus on Mason from first minute to last. And then the other thing is it just makes you realize like how much of childhood is just listening to the adults around you and kind of filtering out what you don't like and accepting what kind of sounds good. There are just so many males throughout the film that are kind of go out of their way to tell Mason their life philosophy and try to make it stick. Like not only the stepfathers, but like his photography teacher and his kind of creepy boss at this fast food restaurant he works at.
Oh, his boss was creepy.
He was pretty creepy. He was funny. I don't know.
I guess I can see how he could be construed as creepy, but
maybe
in a way he's like just aggressively earnest.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, he's so earnest.
Yeah. Like when he's like, you know, I see you as a fry cook. Like that's what I have you pegged as. Like, and it's just like, you know, man, I know that this place is your life, but that doesn't mean a lot to me. But you can kind of see Mason's like the gears in his head turning, where he's like, okay, this is how this guy says he has a lot of faith in me, so yeah, I'll just run with it.
So one of the things I liked about the film is how it sort of showed how Mason's reactions to these, you know, mentor figures changed. Obviously with the stepfathers he doesn't really have any time for them, but with the first one he's so young that he can't really talk back, so he sort of just has to sit there and take it. But in a scene like the dark room scene, which is a pretty long conversation, he actually questions his teacher pretty much about everything. And there's a nice growth implied there, where not only has he learned to just not accept things at face value, but he also wants to kind of complicate the understanding to try to figure things out himself. So I like that also. And then one other thing I'll mention for now is that, you know, the title and everything kind of makes this seem like a universal movie, but I really appreciated how specific to Texas it was.
Yeah.
Cause I have a slightly similar family dynamic, where like my father's side is a bit more right wing. But definitely nothing where I had a birthday and my grandfather gave me a rifle.
It was a shotgun.
Shotgun, sorry. But it was really fascinating to see a kid like Mason negotiate that family line, because the scene where he goes to visit his grandparents is not condescending at all. And
yeah,
he actually, when he does fire the rifle and hit something, it seems like he's having a really good time, even though he's not the kind of person that would ever go out and buy a gun on his own. It's just this sort of nice family moment where, you know, obviously him and his grandfather are completely different people, but in this one afternoon they have this nice little connection. And there's stuff like that throughout that feels very specific to a place that Linklater obviously knows very well. So I appreciated that. Guess I'll hand it off to Brian.
Yeah, it's I love the fact that this actually gives me a good segue. There's a lot in this movie that I love, and one of it is how unimposing and how, I don't want to say undramatic, because that makes it sound like it's not a good movie when I really did like it, but it's a movie that purports to talk about just life, and a lot of movies that do that will still inject some horrifying drama into it. And so like, it was weird, because watching this movie I had to like unteach myself how I have learned to watch movies. So, for instance, a scene in which a teenage Mason is at a friend's house that's being built with his older brothers, and they're like picking up a circular saw blade and throwing it into a piece of drywall. Like, in the back of my head, all I can think is, oh no, this is the scene where someone dies or gets hurt or some terrible incident happens, but it doesn't. And I kept thinking back on my own life. And I it's funny because I use that analogy all the time. I say, if my life was a movie, I would be dead by now. Because the amount of insanely stupid, outright dangerous things that I have done in my life can be numbered in the hundreds. And the fact that I'm still alive is spectacular. And it's because in real life, not every dangerous incident results in mortal death. And I loved that about this movie. You're talking about the gun shooting scene. I had the same concern. I was like, this is when he accidentally shoots someone. And I just I don't know why, but I had to have those feelings. And at some point I learned to trust that the movie was not going to do that. And I really liked that about the film. I liked that it wasn't going to take this so far out of what could be construed as normality for most people. I mean, my friends and I used to play with gasoline, and we used to crawl through the storm drains of our suburban neighborhood, and one time we tried to make a gun.
Jesus.
We were quite possibly the stupidest people ever.
You were one of those kids.
Yeah. We got a friend of ours went to North Carolina, came back with a bunch of fireworks, and so the first thing that we did was set the fireworks in an obstacle course and have to run through the obstacle course with the fireworks exploding around us, pretending that we were in Black Hawk Down or something. Because, you see the war movies and it's oh, that wall just exploded. Oh, the ground around you is getting pockmarked with bullets. And we're won't it be so cool to be able to do that? And we did. And we shot bottle rockets at one another because we're young boys and we're insane. And I loved that about this movie. I don't think a lot of the particulars really apply to me. For instance, my parents are still married, and I've never had to negotiate that. But it still felt very true to life, the interactions that he was having with his parents. And there's a kind of verisimilitude, and a very unpretentious, unassuming verisimilitude. It's not a miserabilist, this is real life, and it's not Requiem for a Dream style. It's just the unassuming culmination of all these events that leads to the present moment. And it's beautiful in its way. And it is very even-handed. It'd be very easy for a movie like this to take pot shots at people, especially as Mason becomes more of a modern millennial, with very socially liberal ideas and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it would be easy for it to let his kind of worldview take over. There is a scene that takes place in a church that his grandparents go to. And every time I see, almost True Detective style, a preacher in the South in a small kind of shack church, preaching from the gospel with the Bible open in his hand, I get this nervous, queasy feeling because I've seen enough movies to know that usually that ends with something very stupid happening. But the words that are being spoken, and it's a story that, any Christian has heard, they're talking about the story of Doubting Thomas. They apply so readily to all life. And it's interesting to see a character who's obviously never really had much of an attachment to religion still hear those words and feel something. And to still understand and kind of respect the fact that one of his birthday presents was a Bible with his name engraved in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tenderness to that and a real humanism. It's like, this might not be important to me, but these people have a concept and they're giving it to me. They're gifting me something that means something to them, and I should respect that for them. And I think that's what really strikes me most about the film and what I like most about it. In addition to that kind of the way that it plays the way you play your own life back. Mm-hmm. You know, there are scenes during this movie where I could say, like, at first I kept trying to do this. I tried to figure out, you know, which jump is this? Like, have we jumped the year yet? And sometimes it's
like a time travel movie. Yeah. like Primer.
I kept expecting, like, dates to come up or, like, you know, like, oh, the first scene of each new year is going to be, like, his birthday or some bullshit like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it plays, it's like, I honestly don't know if he's still 6 or if he's 7 now. I know he's going to a new school, but literally that could be 2 weeks from the last scene I saw in the time of the movie. And that's the way that life plays. I mean, I think back to when I was a kid, I can very clearly see myself wandering around a field trying to catch toads by a creek. And then I see myself years later setting that same creek on fire with gasoline. And I don't have little subtitles saying, this is the year. I just have to remember, in relation to the big rock next to the fallen down tree, when I was hunting the toads, the rock was about my size. And when I was setting the creek on fire, I could very comfortably sit on the rock. I don't have a date. I don't have an age. I have guesses, but I don't even know if they're true. Like, the way that the movie perfectly reflects that almost makes the entire movie feel like a memory of a life lived. And the fact that it is that kid and that you're seeing him grow up, you can't even say, you know, well, in this scene he's Robert Duvall, but in this scene he's Christian Bale. So, you know the split. Like, it doesn't matter. I know that young protagonist is Christian Bale, and I know that old protagonist is Robert Duvall. In this, it's always him. It is him. This is his life. There's the artifice has fallen away. And it's beautiful. And it's striking. And it's interesting what you said, Nick, actually, about how he doesn't feel like he's the protagonist at first. Because in a way, like, you don't acquire a lot of agency in your life until you learn that adults are people too. And I too had a moment where I kind of could feel the shift, like the shift away from, you know, this is a boy who has a mom and a sister, to this is a human being who's realizing that there are things that he doesn't know and that he has to go out and find them out for himself. And I liked that fact. You know, it's I wouldn't say it would be easy to make him the protagonist at the beginning, but I think that if you begin at the concept of this is a mom trying to raise a kid and then transition to this is the young man that she's trying to raise and let's see him grow, it worked for me. I will agree, however, that scene where that little girl is singing Oops, I Did It Again, when that kid threw that pillow at her, I wanted to stand up and cheer.
Oh, another thing that's funny about the daughter's performance is, like, I've read dozens of reviews that say that she gives, like, the best performance in the movie.
Hmm.
Because she's so charismatic, I guess. But, like, to me, while I was watching it, there was, except maybe towards the end of the film where she's obviously older and kind of developed a personality, there was never a moment, like, in the first half of the movie where I thought she was consciously acting. It just seemed so natural. Like, even the scene where they're, like, sitting at the breakfast table and she's just like, the mom's saying they're going to move and she's just like, nope. Like, that just seemed like something that was, like, unconscious. And it's been interesting for me to see all of these critics sort of say that she gives a really good performance. Like, it just kind of complicates your understanding of acting a little bit. Just bit because of the concept of the film. I don't know if you guys have noticed that. I guess not.
I was going to give Nick Newman a chance to.
I didn't think of her performance as the best in the film. I mean, I don't know. I guess I found that the character pretty clearly fades away.
Yeah.
In a sense, which I think is true to when you have an older sibling. You know, they go away. And they have other friends. Who, you know, you see her with a friend briefly, but you don't really know who this person is. I don't even know if you. I'm not even sure if she gets a name. So I guess I didn't really find that it left much of an impression. I didn't think it was a bad performance.
I thought that their relationship was really good, and I think that her performance was a big part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can chart, again, parts of my life based on what relationship I had with my sister. So if we're beating the shit out of each other and trying to get each other in trouble with our parents, I can guess that that's probably 11 and below. she's 4 years older than me. Then a turn came where we weren't so much... We were kind of not so much friends, but, you know, we were just, like, mutually respecting each other as people. And then there was an even more interesting part where we kind of realized that we were, like, two planets orbiting the same black hole. And she just happened to be further towards the event horizon. But that since we were on basically the same path, we could gain a lot from each other. Oddly enough, she asked me for advice a lot more than I ever asked her, which is something that still happens today and that she still jokes about. So watching them, you know, begin in that awful, god-awful moment of her singing Britney Spears and then him finally retaliating, and then when the mom comes in, she just starts crying and saying he threw a pillow at her. I was, like, furious because I've been in that situation. And then seeing the way that they kind of, you know, first they are completely antagonistic, Tom and Jerry. Then they just kind of ignore each other. And then they kind of bond. And then she's gone, but they meet up. And they don't really know each other anymore, but they're kind of mutually respectful when he goes to visit her at college. And she, like, gives him an amount of latitude, and there's kind of this unspoken bond where it's like, I know we're both engaging in stuff that I don't want to know about as your brother or sister, but we're both adults here, and that's fine. That was another one of those aspects that was really true to life for me. And I think what's important here is that it kind of sounds a lot like we're just saying, oh, isn't it cool that this movie reflects life as a normalcy? Like, life in its normalcy is perfectly encapsulated in this film. And that might sound like a very simple, easy thing to do, but it is not. I can't imagine the leaps of faith that it took for 12 years during the course of this movie to continuously say, this year we're not going to do a murder subplot, or this year we're not going to have the mom die in a car accident. This year we're going to go back and we're going to take a look at a person who is living a life fraught with the usual goals, and we're going to make it true, and we're going to make it honest, and we're going to build it out of fiction. I mean, it's almost staggering.
Right.
This movie doesn't take any easy ways.
So let me talk about where I do think it takes an easy way and where I think it falters. Okay.
I should also say, I guess, like, I don't know what spoilers would be for this film. I don't know
Is over by the halfway point of the movie.
What is over?
What I'm going to talk about is over by the halfway point of the movie.
Okay, basically. I was literally just going to say to people, like, we're not going to have, I think, a hard and fast spoiler section. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you've heard us talk about it, and I think we'd all agree that people should go see it, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that's our unequivocal answer. You should go see this. If you'd like us, we're now going to talk, I guess,
I'll
more
also
and
say
more about stuff in the back.
That if your local theater is playing this and Zach Braff's Wish I Was Here, and you choose the latter, I hope you never listen to this show again. I'll say that as well. You don't have to go see the movie, but
you can't.
Considering other options.
What if they see both?
Fine. So long as they pay. If you pay to see Boyhood and then you pop over to Wish I Was Here and don't give Zach Braff money, then okay. But
all right,
anyway.
Well, hopefully we didn't alienate too many people with that.
So, Drunken Stepfather.
Drunken Stepfather. Number
I heard
one.
About this.
This number one guy's a piece of work.
Holy
so
shit.
I had heard about this before I saw the movie, so I was kind of preparing myself for it, and I knew it was coming. But I still found myself struggling with this segment because it, I think, really undercuts a lot of the movie's main motive, which is to, again, you know, present things in a sort of natural fashion, and then it turns into Bigger Than Life or something. Bigger Than Life is a Nicholas Ray movie starring James Mason as a domestic father who takes these pills and it makes him go crazy.
What?
The movie basically turns into that. And I... Yeah, have you ever seen it?
No. I'm going to now, though.
It's an incredible film.
In a good way or a bad way?
Oh, no, in a good way. It's amazing. But... And so the film kind of echoes that in a lot of ways. And to me, it's just... It feels... It's not that the material itself is tired. It's that I just don't think it's handled with such grace. I think that a lot of it feels kind of... I'll give you an example. There's this moment where all the kids are in a car, and the father almost gets into like a car accident, and it feels very rushed. It feels as if it was something that he really came up with on that day.
I do
and it
agree was, with you on that.
It was kind of like his model was working against him at that moment. I mean, if you even look at how it's shot and cut, it looks kind of sloppy, and it just feels like it was never meant to be there. He came up with it 90 minutes before they were going to go shoot, and he thought, okay, let's do this. And it kind of sticks out like a sore thumb because a lot of the movie is otherwise so graceful. There are two things, though. One is that I do think there are some powerful moments in it. I think that there will definitely be people, I think there will be younger people who see this movie who are living in that kind of situation, and they'll see it and they'll find a point of identification for it. And I think the movie handles it well as mm-hmm. far as mining attention from it. And portraying it as a really bad thing without going into histrionics, necessarily. Right. So I think the film does some good for that reason, the way it will connect with people there. Secondly, I also think that... Actually, no, there could be 3 points. That was the first. The second is that I do think there is a sympathy for the character in it, which I find interesting. I think there's a lot of pain when he says to the family, "You don't like me, well, I don't like myself either." Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a lot of truth in that line. That's a classic, torment of an alcoholic.
Absolutely.
How much self-hatred they have. And I think
agree.
That's there.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of, I think it's very upsetting to think about, you know, the guy's 2 children who are left with him. You have no idea.
When they bring that up, like, are we ever going to see them again? She's like, well, you know, I'm not their legal guardian and I can't take them from their father.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a gut punch, and then you don't ever really hear about them again.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know people have been in situations like that, and I just didn't see them anymore because, like, maybe, like, you know, I moved or something, and I don't know whatever happened to them.
Yeah.
And I think the movie does a very good job of just sort of, you know, it never answers that question, which I appreciate. Third, when I said that this movie is like watching. Is like watching the production of the film itself as it goes along. I think this is a theory, so don't take it too seriously. I mean, not that you're going to take anything I say seriously to begin with, but this especially.
Right, not after you slandered Zach Braff like that.
Yeah. I think the movie provides a corrective of itself later with the second drunken stepfather, who has a very different role because by this point the main character has agency and
yes.
he has a personality. And although I like the character very much, he is a little shitty.
Oh, yeah, the kid is a little shitty to his second stepfather.
And I also think that, again, it's the idea of empathy. It's the idea of exposing a certain pain that people have. And this also ties very well to sort of being a chronicle of its time. I was really fascinated watching the 2002 segments because I was thinking to myself, in my mind, I think of 2002... You're going to think I'm making this up and just saying it as a convenient way of making my point, but this is the truth. I think of 2002 in a weird way because it is... That's sort of when I was coming of age. That is post-9/11, pre-Iraq War. That
yeah.
was a very weird time to be alive, especially at that age when
Did
I grew
you,
up with...
How old were you?
I was... Most of the time I was 9.
Every now and then I was 32, but most of the time I was 9.
Excepting the first 2.5 to 3 months, basically.
Okay.
But that was also one of the first times I was, like, aware of the world around me. And, you know, growing up in that time, I mean, I think about this often. I thought about it before I saw the movie. I've been thinking about it for years. I didn't even realize at the time what a weird time that was to be alive and not realizing what a horrible spiral the country was about to go into. And the movie, it boomerangs back to us. The movie starts, there was no conflict in Iraq at the time. When the movie ends, there is a character who has been severely damaged by this event.
Yeah.
It has been going on in the background. It's been going on...
It's on TV. The dad's upset about it.
It's on TV. In one of the movie's clunkier attempts to connect it to the time, there's like a TV, like, look at the TV, look at the TV. That's a little clunky.
Yeah.
But, again, this is the idea of corrective. there's this horrible, horrible thing that's going on in the background, and then it comes back at us. And it happens with this guy who, I mean, you know, these are people who, you know, had to, who couldn't shit in a normal schedule. They had to run down a hill and shit together and then run back up so they wouldn't be blown up for a war that served no purpose, for a war that was technically started on illegal grounds. And then they come back, and what do you do? Like, what the fuck do you do? And, you know, he comes back and he has this stepson who is, you know, kind of a, you know, no pun intended, a slacker, who is kind of drifting about. And I think there's a lot of empathy and sympathy in the shot where he turns around and you see his back and the shirt says corrections officer.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's like, that's, he was a soldier and now he is this. Like,
yeah.
That hurt. It hurt a little bit less than I did initially, because when I saw the badge on his arm, mm-hmm. I thought he was like a mall cop.
Right.
So the fact that he at least had like a government job, you know, made me feel a little bit better. But I mean, like, that's still, you know, a very rough reward for this guy to come back to home to.
Right.
And then that the kid is kind of a piece of shit to him.
Mm-hmm. So I think that the movie, you think about these two, you contrast these two, and I think you really have to contrast these two. There's such a difference in there, and it feels like Linklater, I don't want to say he tried to do something, I don't want to say he tried to redo it, make it better, but that's what it felt to me. It felt like he was improving upon ground that was already tread, and that was fascinating to watch.
It's
even
also
if,
kind of interesting about that, because you can almost read that also as the mother, likewise, like, trying to improve upon it.
Right.
Like, finding another person. You know, the first time it was her teacher, and then the second time, mm-hmm. she's now the teacher. This guy, you know, is younger instead of quite older, it seemed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I did wonder about that. I wondered about a couple of things. Because of the way the movie's shot, I didn't know how much Linklater planned out. So when she first marries her professor, was it always known that he was going to be an alcoholic? And that, you know what,
right.
I know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think he planned from the beginning that there would be like two stepfathers, you know? Mm-hmm. I think he plotted out those major points. But you mean like he just doesn't seem like an alcoholic at first?
I mean, he seems like a lech and a creep at first.
Yeah.
But the revelation of his, I mean, I guess this is just how life is. The revelation of his alcoholism feels a little abrupt. Like he immediately seems like a very like hateful person. his the scene where they've just gotten back from their honeymoon and he's talking to his kids, and like when he is talking about the chores and everything.
Oh yeah.
Like, not a nice dude at all.
He has like a drink in that scene.
He does. Well, yeah. Oh yeah, he does.
Quite intricate drink. He like hides it behind the detergent.
Oh man. Yeah. I was wondering about that, because it did seem a little abrupt. But I mean, like, that's just the kind of thing that I guess could be abrupt to discover.
Hmm.
So I don't know. I was interested to hear if y'all had any thoughts on that.
No, I don't know. I mean, it's also when you don't get hints that he's you don't get hints that the second guy has some sort of temper. He's actually mm-hmm. quite nice throughout. He wishes Mason a happy birthday. He's the first person to wish him, I think it's like his 15th.
Yeah, he's like, Mason comes home and he's like, "Hey Mason, like, what time is it?" And Mason's like 12:15, and I was like, "Uh-oh, he's going to be pissed that Mason was late," but then he's like, "Happy birthday, buddy." And everyone's like, "Oh my god, yay."
Right.
Yeah, he didn't seem that bad.
So I don't know. I mean, I think also it's kind of goes back to what I said, where I sort of have that theory that the movie is actually someone looking back on their life instead of living through it in the present moment.
That's 100% what it felt like to me.
Okay. Because I haven't heard anyone say this, so it's interesting.
Yeah, no. When they're sitting there in the desert at the end having that conversation, I mean, that felt like that's the only really sustained scene. You know what I mean? Like, driving to college, gets to college, goes out with these people. It's like mm-hmm. the longest arc that's a single narrative moment.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I just thought I would sound like an asshole if I said that out loud. So I'm glad you went for it first.
Just to go back to that.
It's actually a peyote trip. That's makes me think of it in a lot of ways.
To go back to the idea of there being like no title cards, I think by the end of that movie, that decision is like it pays off incredibly well. I mean, but I think by the time he's like 10 or something, each year jump is very obvious, and the extremes between each year is pretty fascinating. And actually, one of the funniest moments I thought is it's probably the year after he like starts wearing the earring, kind of takes on that persona. And it cuts to this morning scene between him and his mom, and he's dressed in like a polo shirt and khaki pants. And I was like, what the hell happened to this guy after he was like wearing an earring and had like painted nails? And of course that turns out to be like his restaurant uniform.
Yeah.
But at first while I was watching that scene, I was so shocked because I was like, whoa, is this who he is now? Like he's wearing like khakis. And, yeah. And then a similar thing, too, with, like, his personality. Because, I mean, in the scene where he's, like, driving with his girlfriend and he's talking about all this stuff about, like, you know, about why Facebook's bad and stuff. I was just thinking back to, like, freshman year in college. And if anyone started talking to me about why they thought Facebook was, like, ruining society, I would have been like, all right, shut the fuck up. Like, I don't want to talk to you. But just because of the way the movie's structured, you almost understand that innately as like just one phase in his development. So like if this movie did go on for another year, you know, I'd be fascinated to see how much just the first year of college changed him. And it probably happened the same thing for each year after that.
That
so
was
I think,
legitimately a thought I had.
Yeah.
You know, this is Linklater, the guy who did Before Sunrise, Sunset, and then Midnight. And I was like, what are the odds that in 12 years we'll have another one of these?
Under the radar.
Yeah, somehow. So they shot Midnight under the radar too, didn't they?
Yeah, but that was also, you know, that didn't take 12 years.
No, it didn't take 12 years, and it was like two people.
Oh, and then I remember one other funny detail that Nick mentioned in his review, but it's like in his interview. The scene where him and his girlfriend are like eating nachos and there's like that mumbling character from Slacker I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, it was funny. That was good.
So yeah, any final thoughts on this? I feel like I've said my piece.
What did you guys think of the soundtrack? I was a bit mixed on it myself. I love
beginning Love with Coldplay.
Oh, God. Okay, here's a friend of mine wrote a review on the website Tiny Mixtapes.
Okay.
So you can go read it there. He actually had like an interesting defense, not a defense of it, just saying why he thinks it works. And he said that one of the things it does, I'm just going to like kind of paraphrase him, is that it takes this very, you know, popular piece of pop culture and just kind of plays with it in a weird way where the line is, you know, look at the stars, see how they shine for you, but he's actually looking up at, you know, the daylight where there are no stars.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a distortion of, it sort of speaks to the way that we might inhabit pieces of popular culture. We might make them our own, even if they're not really supposed to be.
I thought of it almost
that much
as,
being said, that much still be, I mean, still, when it started with that, I went, what's going on here?
I thought it was just them being like, hey, remember 2002? And then, but here's something I noticed. So it begins with that, and what is that song? Yellow?
Yeah.
Okay, so look at the stars, look how they shine for you and everything that you do. It's a very, like, egocentric song.
Mm-hmm.
It's a song that very much puts the world on a single person. And then the song that's featured in the trailer that plays during his trip to college is, I don't want to be your hero. I don't want to be a big man. I just want to, I think, fight like somebody else or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a song that is, like, denying that. Like, it's almost like a rebuke to Yellow. It's like, look at the stars, look at how they shine for you. It's like, I don't want to be your hero.
And then there's
Let
also,
me go. Like,
And then the last, you know, the end credits play for Arcade Fire is Deep Blue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, here in my place and time, and here in my own skin, I can finally begin.
Yeah.
And then there's the line, the second half of that verse, let the century pass me by, standing under the night sky, tomorrow means nothing. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I mean, you know, it's not the same as, like, commissioning a song like My Heart Will Go On that basically explains the entire movie. Mm-hmm. But it is a way to kind of bookend the film and give it that statement of, like, this is a kid who, when you're a child, like, the world is all for you. Like, everyone's fucking working on making your life better. And then there is that weird shift where people are like, okay, well, what are you going to do? It's like, what do you mean? What am I going to do? I'm going to keep going to school. You people are going to keep feeding me. And that's that's worked pretty well for us for the last 10 years. Why does it have to change? And then you start to realize that, like, that isn't it. Like, you were helpless then, and now that you're taller and older and hopefully smarter, you know, within a couple of years you're going to maybe have kids of your own. Like, you're going to start kicking that shit into shape. And one of the things I like about the film is how it very subtly and easily demonstrates that even the goddamn adults are not anywhere near as put together as they expect this kid to be towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
The mother is literally married 3 times. The first time it was, you know, kind of seemed like it was an accident because they had kids and, you know, the dad just wasn't there. He was a little flighty. He hadn't matured enough. And then she goes raging alcoholic, then depressive alcoholic. And now she's realizing that, you know, she had made this kid the center of her life. And now that he has to go out and, you know, realize that that's not his position anymore, she feels unmoored because her gravitational center is zipped off. And so now her momentum will take her God only knows where.
Yeah, I thought that was a really sad way to leave her.
Yeah.
Even, like, over his final scene, I was feeling her pain. Because it almost makes it worse that he's, like, having such a good time, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought that was really devastating.
Yeah.
It's a depressing. Well, speaking of depressing ways to leave people, I guess that'll be the last that we say on this film.
Goyhood.
Boyhood. It's out in theaters now. It's
Goyhood. Sorry. I just love saying that.
It's a really fantastic film, and it's making a lot of money.
It is.
Yeah.
I went and saw this, and I had 2 choices of times. They were maybe like 40 minutes apart. And when I got to the theater, there was like the ticketing system at the Landmark in Bethesda is such that you choose your own seats before the film so that you can, like, get a drink at the bar and you don't have to rush in. You don't have to show up that much early. It also tells you the percentage of seats that are left. And both of those theaters, it was like 8% of tickets left. And the only seats available were, like, right up front. So, this movie, I think, rightly is getting a lot of attention, and I think it deserves it. I think it's good.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on and let's get into the things that are coming out in the week ahead. It's going to DVD and Blu-ray on July 29th. A couple of options here. Noah hitting the Blu-ray, and I'm looking forward to that.
That one Noah cover is terrible.
The one with, like, the floating heads over.
Yeah,
there. Yeah,
the hell is it? The other one's not bad.
The other one's not terrible, but it's,
what the hell is that?
The one with just Russell Crowe holding an axe.
Yeah, at least it's, like,
I don't know,
the color looks better.
Yeah, I don't even know what they're doing with that. That's just terrible. anyway, The Other Woman is coming out. Are those the only? Those look like the only two, like, new releases. I will, however, say that Twin Peaks. What do they call this? The Entire Mystery. That's what they're calling the Blu-ray collection. That's hitting. So look forward to that. Also, a Criterion Blu-ray re-release of The Big Chill.
And also a Werner Herzog box set, which is 16 films on Blu-ray. It's pretty cool.
Speaking of Werner Herzog,
yeah, that's insane.
Spoiler alert for my pick for the week.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's probably Jack Reacher, you motherfucker.
It totally is.
Great.
Anyway, so that's Blu-ray.
Very excited for Twin Peaks. I have the gold box, and I still bought this Blu-ray set.
Is this the one they shot new stuff for, and it kind of gives closure to...
Yeah, that's on there, as well as 90 minutes of deleted scenes from Fire Walk With Me that haven't been seen, well, ever, but were shot, you know,
yeah,
shot more than 20 years ago, never seen. Very exciting.
All right. Well, that's going to be pretty goddamn awesome. Coming to theaters, meanwhile, we have Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the newest film in the Marvel Universe, directed by James Gunn, starring Chris Pratt, Bradley Cooper, Zoe Saldana, and a couple other people. Get On Up. This is the biopic of James Brown. We also have Calvary, starring Brendan Gleeson and Chris O'Dowd. What If, which is something I don't believe I've ever heard of. It has Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan in it, as well as Adam Driver.
Yeah, so, I've heard good things about that.
Okay, I was about to say, this is like an indie darling's wet dream.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I don't know how indie Daniel Radcliffe is, since
he
headlined the biggest franchise in film history.
Oh, yes. I mean, Harry Potter.
But I mean, like, he hasn't continued to pursue giant blockbusters. Any of these striking your interest? I'm vaguely interested in seeing Guardians of the Galaxy, but I'm so fucking tired of Marvel. I can't. I don't want to go. I just, like, you know, like, if it could play in my house, if this were on VOD, I'd watch it, but, like, I just can't fathom paying another movie ticket to go and see a Marvel movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like I'm tired. And I absolutely loved Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just nothing about this that's really, like, cracking my interest. And it's got a fucking raccoon that shoots a machine gun. Like,
it's got an interesting cast.
I like Chris Pratt. He's half the reason I'm looking forward to Jurassic World.
Mm-hmm.
The other half is the fact that it's a Jurassic Park movie.
Right.
Also, the plot synopsis for that sounds insane.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that shit. But yeah, Chris Pratt, I mean, I like him. I like Zoe Saldana. She was great in everything that she's been in.
Mm-hmm.
Bradley Cooper's a talking fucking raccoon with a machine gun. I can't, like, the thought of, like, knowing that I'm going to the movie theater and then sitting in the movie theater knowing that it's going to be a Marvel movie playing, it just tires me. Which is the weirdest thing, because, like, the trailer that they have, the two trailers they've done have both been really good.
Right.
It's just the concept of being there.
For me, it's sort of the feeling of, like, thinking about other things I could be doing with my time. Really.
I don't even, you know, I'm sure this is better than a lot of things that I'll probably be forced to do next weekend.
Oh, no, but I mean, when I think about, like, if I have that free time, like, other movies I could be watching, or I could be, like, reading a book, or...
Yeah, I guess...
Going for a walk.
It doesn't feel special anymore, you know? Like...
No.
Iron Man felt special. Right. The Dark Knight trilogy I kind of put on its own thing, because those were, like, different movies. But, like, the big grand action fun time comic book films that Marvel puts out, like, the reason I liked Winter Soldier so much is because it was basically 3 days of the Condor.
Well, I remember when The Incredible Hulk came out, like, a month after Iron Man, and he had a cameo at the end. I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And you can know it's like, oh, God, I have to sit through the post-credit sequence.
Now there are two post-credit sequences. There's a mid-credits and a post-credits.
Right. It's
And the mid-credits is always, like, the MCU, the Marvel Comics universe. And Right. Then the really post-credits one is usually, like, a proper ending to the film.
Well, Josh Brolin plays Thanos.
Oh, he is? Well, you know, after I saw him in Labor Day...
Mm.
I just can't get me enough of Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
Still got to see Labor Day.
You do. I really want you all to see
Drunk Cast.
Drunk Cast. We got to figure out when we're going to start doing that.
Not too often.
Not too often. Today would have been a good day for it. I could stand to still be drunk right now. That's it for coming to theaters. I really want to see Calvary.
Yeah, I want to see that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was a huge fan of The Guard, his previous film.
Indeed.
The Guard is terrific.
All right, well, let's talk about films that we watched in our own time, and then we can get out of here. So, Danny King, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, I have no problem doing such a thing.
Okay, good.
I watched Nil by Mouth, which is the only movie Gary Oldman's directed.
Okay.
From 1997, and it's brutal.
okay.
Ray Winstone. I mean, it takes place in London, and Ray Winstone just stars as this alcoholic, terrible husband. One of his friends is a heroin addict. His other friend is another very bad person.
Is the stepdad from Boyhood in this movie?
No, he was almost in it, but
okay.
Oldman was like, "Nah, we'll leave you for Linklater." I don't know why I said that, but it's a really good movie. It's just it's so devastating, and it actually ends with one of the most haunting title cards I can remember. It says, "In memory of my father."
Oh, wow.
And I know that, I think in his recent Playboy interview, he kind of came out and said, like, you know, I'm not trying to imply that this was like directly autobiographical, because a lot of the stuff in the movie is absolutely horrific. So it's worth mentioning that, but still to watch the movie for 2 hours, and take in all of that assault, and then just to be left with that title card is like unforgettable. And so I would recommend the movie if you can just be prepared for it. A friend of mine pretty smartly compared the first half hour or so to like John Cassavetes films. It opens with this scene over the opening credits where Ray Winstone is at a bar and he's ordering a drink, and the way Oldman does it is really interesting. He's like showing him like, "Hey, can I get three beers?" And then there'll be like one title card with a credit, and then it'll go back to Winstone and be like, and a gin and tonic, and then it'll do another credit, and he keeps adding these drinks on, and it's like, dude, how many fucking drinks are you buying? And then he takes them to his friend's table, and they just talk for like 10 minutes, and it's all of these like close-ups, and everything they're saying is just terrible. It's probably got like, I don't know, 300, not 300. It's got a lot of uses of the C word, stuff like that. A
lot, but not 300.
Yeah, not 300. But I mean, it's just like, this movie just gets at you. And I think he's working on a new movie about Edward Muybridge that probably sounds like a bit different.
Edward Muybridge has a history too.
Okay.
So it seems like that's probably in the same wheelhouse.
Okay, that could be then. Yeah. I guess at least maybe a little bit bigger of a budget. Maybe or maybe not. But yeah, it's a good movie. So if you can get yourself in the mindset, I'd recommend it.
Nick Newman.
So I was actually going to recommend this movie, you know, 90 minutes after watching it in one of our several attempts to record this episode. So I'll bring it up now, about a week after the fact. That movie is Not on the Lips, a 2003 musical directed by Alain René, the great Alain René, who we have discussed on the show before. Unfortunately, it was when he died, like several hours before we recorded.
Yeah.
We woke up and found that news. So, still, it's a late-era René film, which kind of, you know, if you've seen his earlier stuff, it's not necessarily in the same category. He kind of later adapted more of a fondness for long shots and wide shots and extended takes, as opposed to his very cut-emphasized form of cinema. And this is, again, it's a musical, and it's very, you know, proud of being a musical. It's very buoyant about its status as a musical. It has a lot of fun with itself, basically, is what I'm trying to say. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie with a lot of actors who he'd later work with, including Lambert Wilson, who plays an American, which means that you're watching a French actor sing while doing an American accent. And it's kind of like this weird act of acrobatics, which the movie didn't necessarily require, but which René put in nevertheless, I think, because he just sort of found the idea of it amusing, and he decided to do it. And that's sort of a spirit which I think permeates a lot of very crisscrossy, multi-person, you know, who's going in what direction sort of plot, which it never really puts too much emphasis on. A lot of it is just kind of built on a scene-by-scene basis, which is fine because Rene is such an incredible filmmaker and can milk everything possible out of a performance and a song and a dance move, which puts it above most modern musicals, if not every modern musical that I can think to name. It's a really wonderful, joyous piece of work, and it actually, I think, serves as an interesting sort of touchstone in the Rene au revoir, because that sounds so French, those two words.
Rene au revoir.
The Renaissance of the Rene au revoir.
God damn it.
But because the movie kind of, I think, at the end posits that, you know, sometimes fakery is okay if you get what you want in the end. It's okay to sometimes pass things off as something that they are not, which I think is a central tenet of Rene's filmography. A lot of his movies are about false surfaces, and they present false surfaces for their final result. And the way it sort of comments upon that without winking too much at the camera, I found really delightful, because that's something that I've always identified as a strong component of his films. So in addition to just being a really joyous time, I think it is an important piece in the work of, you know, one of the greatest filmmakers who's ever lived. Not on the lips. You can rent the DVD from Netflix. It's not very difficult to find, although it never received distribution in the United States, which I think is ridiculous. I don't know how this movie wouldn't get sold when it's such a joy. I really recommend people see it. So.
All right, well, I'm going to talk about Jack Reacher, which is now on Netflix. I was sick last week. Oh, that was why we couldn't record on Monday. I was sick.
Right.
Jesus. Anyway, so I was sick last week, and so I'm on the couch, and I want to watch a movie, and Jack Reacher comes on, and I remember hearing some pretty good things. I remember thinking that the movie looked like shit, but I remember hearing good things, and I've got some goodwill moving up towards Tom Cruise because of Edge of Tomorrow. And also, I had just seen Top Gun, so I was on a cruise kick, and I was on cruise control. Too much? Okay. So I was on a big thing about Tom Cruise. So I see Jack Reacher, and I'm like, you know what? I'll watch it. And it's actually a fun movie. I enjoyed it. It's kind of a good old fashioned, like, it feels a little bit in. I say this in the best way. It feels like a 90s movie. Like, you know, this guy is coming to town, he's gonna get shit done. And, he does. And, yeah. I don't know. It's also got the weirdest villain casting. It's got Werner Herzog in it. And I swear to God that they probably just let him talk every time he was on screen. He has a monologue that he gives where he's trying to get a guy to chew off two of his own fingers.
Oh, God.
Brutal. And it's perfect. It is amazing. Like, Herzog in this film, it's like they don't use him enough, basically. Like, usually when you have a villain like that, you're like, okay, this guy, he's a little too much. I don't know if we should keep going with this. I wanted, like, a full-on backstory. I want a prequel.
I remember him not being in it that much.
Yeah, and it's sad, because, like, his two scenes are amazing. I love him in this movie. And it's just, like, I could just imagine going up to a casting director and just being like, okay, I know we've got this guy who's supposed to be a really threatening villain, and I really think that Werner Herzog is the best person for this part. And they would look at him, this casting director, and be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And then he would, like, put on the white crocodile monologue from, like, the Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and then just say, now imagine this if it was said to you by a person leering at you in a dark alley. And then everyone immediately was like, you know what, you're a goddamn genius. Not to mention that Tom Cruise is great in it, doing his Tom Cruise-y thing. The mystery and the detective work, it actually involves, like, detective work. It's not like, oh, something that we never told you before, and, like, this just random chance. It's good. I liked it a lot. It's quite a film. It's a good time. It's on Netflix, so like, you know, what do you have to lose? Nick, did you see this, or were you just upset because you were excited for me to say like Fitzcarraldo?
Just because I knew it was going to be this. It's not. I don't have anything against Jack Reacher. It was just, I don't know. It's so predictable. Never mind. I'm sure it's fine. I've heard good things. I'll see it at some point. But, yeah. Nothing against it.
Okay. All right. Anyway, that's all for today. I don't know what we're talking about next week. It could be Guardians of the Galaxy. Or it could be something else completely. Really no way to tell right now. We'll watch the Twitter feed at Film Stage Show. Maybe we'll tell you then. But until then, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found online. Danny King, where can the fine people find you?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, twitter.com/thekingbulletin, and Boyhood.
Okay. Nick Newman, where can we find you?
You can also find me at Boyhood, in Boyhood. Also,
let's all claim to have been in Boyhood.
Also, the film stage. Well, we were in some sense.
All right, right.
I'm also, just, the film when did they film some of those scenes? Because maybe I was. I think like that game, the Astros game, I might have been there. Anyway.
I actually saw someone tweeted out they think they found when it was. It would have been like August 2005.
Holy shit. Well,
you might have been there.
I was living in Houston at the time, and I do remember going to games then.
Was it Roger Clemens pitching?
Yeah, the Rocket was back.
Mm. Oh,
that's interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's
film,
cool.
Boyhood, as well as thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can maybe even actually, like not even joking, find me in Boyhood. That's cool. Thefilmstage.com, obviously twitter.com/BrianJRowan. You can find my reviews on things that I've watched personally at dearfilm.net, and usually at the bottom of a bottle that I bought saying it was just in case we had company. We never have company. That's a depressing line too.
Brutal.
No one comes over. Anyway. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, and I look forward to speaking with you next week.